A friend of mine was talking to me about a difficulty a friend of his was experiencing. It was all tied up with the financial crisis that we're experiencing globally, or have been experiencing globally. In this particular situation, this man had been a co-worker of my friend, and he had run a very solid business for a period of time, and then the sort of worldwide possibility of gaining a great deal for very little effort overtook his better judgment, and he entered into the financial dealings that we all have read and heard so much about that I don't have to explain. Greed overcame his common sense, and now he finds himself utterly ruined. And also, even far more profoundly upsetting to him, having squandered the money of people who trusted him. And my friend was just talking to me about how painful it was to see his friend faced with the embarrassment, with the disappointment, with the irresponsibility, all of the just many factors that you could imagine. He was also talking about how his friend was essentially cracking under the strain and just didn't really know quite what to do. It's a very strong impulse when we see people suffering that on a deep level, somehow we want to alleviate that suffering. I mean, that's just a natural human response, isn't it? I recall when David's father died and his mother was still living after 60 years of marriage. We were not as closely involved with her. She's gone from the planet now too. But one of David's siblings was. And out of affection for her mother, she gathered her mother up immediately. She lived on one side of the country, and she gathered her up and moved her across the country and established her in a new apartment and was taking care of her and was taking her out and making sure that she stayed busy and all these different things that a loving child might do when faced with the sudden death of a parent like that. We went to visit. And I watched his mother sort of gradually arrange things so she could be alone with us. And as soon as she was alone with us, she began to weep about the tremendous change in her life, the passing of her husband. And also she explained to us that her other child was being so attentive and so concerned about her that she didn't want to appear ungrateful by crying in front of her. And so you see how complex it becomes. And all of a sudden she's grateful to us because we're not trying hard to comfort her, that we're just being there and letting her express what she can't express in another setting, which is how absolutely devastated she is to have her life turned upside down after 6 decades of marriage. Now, how often in our well-meaning but misguided attempts, we try to really come between a person and what God is trying to do for them. I know when my own parents were elderly, those of you who've been in the congregation a long time have heard me speak about that experience. They lived in Southern California. I lived here. By the end of my mother's life especially, I was flying back and forth from Los Angeles at least once, sometimes even twice a week. My mother became increasingly unreasonable. She was mentally fine, but she just became unreasonable. She had Parkinson's, and it was very difficult for her. The final straw was when she called me and told me it was absolutely urgent that I come down and see her, and I had a class to teach and many things to do. And I dropped everything, and I got on a plane, and I flew down there. And she wanted me to make a dentist appointment for her. You know, I had to actually walk out of the house. You know, just go outside and breathe a little bit and just sort of see it from her point of view. After my mother died, dear soul that she was, I had a couple of dreams about her that I believe were true dreams. And the first one, she was in the astral world, and she'd had this debilitating disease for almost 15 years. And as I understand it, if you die having been ill for a long time, even after you've shed your body, sometimes it takes you a while to realize you're not sick anymore. That's why Master says very strongly, you know, even never accept the thought of illness. Even if you die, never accept the idea that you're ill. Now that's a very tricky thing you have to carry out because you can't live in a state of ridiculous pretense. But what he means is never deeply identify with that ill body. Even though the body may obviously be sick unto death, that doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with me. So that as soon as that body is shed, I go forward. Well, my mother, I think, was caught in the idea of illness, and she went to the astral world, and as I understand, I've heard this from other sources too, there's kind of like an astral hospital where they'll take people who still think they're sick. And in this dream, my mother summoned me, and she, in her way, she summoned me and she had me sit right next to her, and she kind of looked around, you know, to make sure nobody was listening. And then she told me, there's some things that I need for you to do. She says like this. I said, Mother, I believe there's a lot of people here who can help you. She kind of darted around. I don't think they can help me in the way that you can, like this. This sort of intense energy of slight paranoia and desire to control. And I mean, she was a fine person and a good mother, but especially toward the end, she had some odd characteristics. I just smiled at her and I said, Mom, this is all in a dream, but I think it was real. I said, Mom, I think they can do just fine. And then I sort of backed away from her, you know, and just left her there. I should say, well, just to complete the story, the second dream I had of her, my father was still living, and she came to see him. And she was still elderly, but she was much stronger. And she came to visit him in this dream. And my father, of course, was delighted to see her. And the two of them went off into their bedroom and they shut the door. And then after a few minutes, I heard my mother calling me, just in sort of this sort of high-pitched calling. And I opened the door and she had become ill again, like this. And I sort of grabbed her and pulled her away from my father and pushed her away. I said, you can't be with us because the thought form is still too strong. Go back, go away, like this. Get out of these memories. And then she went. Then the last dream I had of her, she looked about 24 years old. She looked radiantly beautiful, and she was just standing looking out a window, looking as happy as she could be, just to finish it. My father physically was fine, but he began to lose his mind. He became a very cheerful, demented fellow, and we had a wonderful last few years. He was just as sweet as he could be. When he forgot what he was supposed to be uptight about, he just became so cheerful. But the saga of getting to this comfortable point, and not merely to have them leave the planet and go on to their next lives, the saga was a profound and a deep one for me, because I'm a very executive type. And I like to help people. And as they became diminished, my capacity proportionally to help them, you know, became larger and larger. Their demands on me became quite large. I profoundly and deeply do not want to have to face the karma again, so I was eager to do it properly. But I watched myself. The only thing I can say is try to interfere with the natural flow of their own necessity to learn. And it became an extremely subtle and important lesson for me that I've learned applies more than just to geriatric friends. Because we think, we have this such a strong association in our own minds between suffering and something we don't want, that we're always taking life that comes to us in so many different forms, and we're dividing it up into that which we want and that which we don't want. In our reading today, there's this very important line: learn to accept what comes to you unasked as God's way of healing you. And even in the act of healing, trying to heal you, God is showing you his love. Now, healing, of course, is a word that has many levels of meaning, but the primary thing that we're trying to be healed from at all time is truthfully our ability to suffer. Whether we suffer because of physical illness, because of financial stress, because of emotional loneliness, because of profound regret over our own stupidities, whatever it is that we suffer from, the nature of all of creation, Swamiji explains to us in the tradition of India, is Satchit Ananda, ever existing, ever conscious, ever new joy. That is the substance of this universe, and all of us, in those moments when our consciousness is clear and calm, whether that comes to us in the depths of meditation, by the fruit of our own personal spiritual effort, whether it comes to us when we're walking out in the wilderness or in some beautiful point in nature, and all of a sudden that whole burden of self just goes away. I pray that all of you have had this experience. I'm sure at one moment or another you have. Maybe it comes when you have a newborn baby and you're holding that tiny baby in your arms and this sense of perfect love is between you and everything of self just falls away. In other words, for a moment, we cease to identify and define ourselves as this cramped, limited, vulnerable being that we imagine ourselves to be, and we're liberated from all that delusion, and we see life as it really is. Swamiji defines the spiritual path as the gradual ability to see things as they are, not merely as they appear to be. Now, as soon as we have that moment, it comes so deep into us, it becomes, for many of us, it becomes the dominating theme of our lives. You know, decades of our lives become a deep effort to get back to that moment. You know, that moment also comes, I feel I have to say, often through music or the performance of any creative action, where there's just nothing but the flow of energy. Now, that's what true health is, and that's what God is trying to give us. He's trying to show us the power and strength of our true nature, and that whatever else comes, no matter what storms may happen on the surface of the ocean, if we have expanded our consciousness to embrace the entire ocean, we can ride those waves, but it never touches who and what we really are. This is to be healed, and this is the job that the divine, this is the responsibility that the divine, whether we call it divine mother outside of ourselves or our own inner aspiration that will not give us peace until that realization is ours. And always what is happening through the entire course of incarnation after incarnation is that realization is growing within us. And just like a little child, as his little feet get bigger and bigger and he begins to split through his shoes, and after a while those shoes just won't fit anymore. The very seams of those shoes just split apart. And even as they split apart, they rip. And even as they're ripping, the foot may feel cramped, but it will continue to grow until it's broken out of that confining force. So all of us within ourselves have this, what we might describe as an infinite bubble of joy that is ever going to keep expanding. And when it hits the edge of our karmically imposed, self-imposed karmic limitations, I can't live without this. I couldn't handle it if that happened. This is who I am and I could never be different. Whatever it is, it hits up against that force, keeps pushing and pushing, and then whatever it is that is holding it begins to crack apart. And we see the ripping and the tearing. And often what's being ripped and torn is something that we are really attached to and have been for a really long time. You know, this is my favorite sweater. What will I do if I don't have this sweater anymore? This is the coat I've always worn. This is how my hair has always looked. This is the body I've always been in. I have always been a strong, capable person. I'm the one who earns lots of money. I have good health. I have a sharp and capable mind. Whatever it might be, the bubble keeps expanding until that skin is ripped apart. Ram Dass, Richard Alpert, a very intellectual man from Harvard who played a key role in the late 60s, mostly with drugs, but he wrote some good books, Be Here Now and others, and eventually became a dedicated disciple of a good master, Neem Karoli Baba from India. And the end of this story is only this, that this man who lived primarily and powerfully through his extraordinary intellect and his amazing verbal ability suffered a stroke. And when he suffered a stroke, he developed aphasia. He couldn't speak. First, he couldn't speak at all. And then even when speech has been restored to him, he can't find the words. He speaks at a fraction of the speed he used to speak at. Everything about his entire sense of self was gone. And it happened in a split second, as he describes it. He was lying in bed, thinking about a book he was writing, and then he was on the floor. Something happened in between. And so he had a stroke, but because he'd been a devotee for a long time and because he was striving faithfully to be a faithful disciple, he no longer said, "I had a stroke." He said, "My guru stroked me." And then he described what happened to him as fierce grace. There's a lovely documentary about him with that name, Fierce Grace. And he describes in his halting way, he said, "Because I knew it had to be grace, but it was a fierce experience for him." And I find that such an interesting way to think about it. Even the effort to try to heal us is an act of God's love for us. Now, for us, you see, this puts a tremendous responsibility to have the same courage in the face of the challenges that we and others must be subjected to that God has in inflicting them on us. Like Mother Teresa said, "God never gives me more than I can handle, but sometimes I wish he didn't trust me so much." Isn't that a natural feeling? We say over and over again, "This is more, this isn't what I wanted, this is more than I can do." But there's this impersonal appreciation of our divine potential. Now, in the Bible, Jesus uses that phrase, "Be therefore perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect." We talked about this some last week, and it's such an important phrase. It comes up again this Sunday, too. There's so many different aspects of that, and the previous parts of it are Jesus talking about, well, you can be good in this way, but I love the part, even the tax collectors do that, you know. Or if you're just gracious and kind and loving to the things that you already define as positive, what have you really accomplished? So happy things happen and you respond gracefully. Hooray. I mean, if you really look at it like that, so when everything suits you, you're very cheerful, this is an accomplishment. Even the tax collectors can do that. Last week we were told even the Pharisees did that. But what he's really trying to say is our potential is so much greater than is obvious to us when we just look around. And we have this instinctive desire to hold ourselves small and even to help other people be small. You know, I remember in one master was saying once what the phrase is, "He who loves you more than your mother is a witch." That's an Indian saying. It's a strange saying. But what he's trying to say is that the mother, and the way Master described this, he said, when the mother disciplines you, she's disciplining you out of love because she knows what's best for you. And anyone who comes in and says, "Oh no, your mother's being too harsh on you." Or as Master said, when Master would discipline people and others would come between, "Oh, he's being unreasonable. You shouldn't listen to him. You shouldn't be like that." There was this young boy at Mount Washington, and every time Master tried to discipline him, he would run to his mother and say, "Oh, Mommy, he's being mean to me." And the mother would always take the child's side. And so Master, after a while, just knew that there was nothing he could do with the boy. And to a certain extent, there wasn't much he could do with the mother either. Because the mother was more interested in keeping him small than she was in having the courage to stand by her child while the guru tried to make him great. You see? We don't always have the guru in the physical body. But when life sends us something unexpected, Swamiji teaches us this when he talks about counseling. He said, as a rule, it's helpful when you're counseling someone to be compassionate toward their suffering. But sometimes it's good not to be too compassionate. He said, sometimes when you express too much sympathy for people suffering, it only increases the idea in their mind that their suffering is really great. He said, and you don't want to increase that thought. You want to increase the thought in their mind that with God's everlasting help, whatever comes to me, I can face it. What we want to give each other is courage. And sometimes comfort gives courage, but it's also a little bit of a fine line. When we would go to India over the years, for about 20 years, maybe 10 or 12 times, we took pilgrimage groups to India starting in 1986. And for many people who came with us because they'd never traveled in India or they'd never traveled in an underdeveloped country. And so we were exposed to many sights and sounds and visions and situations that many Westerners were not used to. You know, staying in this 5-star hotel in Calcutta and in these beautiful, beautifully appointed rooms with marble fixtures and so on like that, and looking out the window for the 4 or 5 days we were there and watching the family that lived on the sidewalk right below. You know, the 3 or 4 children, the father going off and doing his work, watching them cook, watching them bed down at night, watching them live in their tiny little ragged garments. I mean, that was just one example, having the bus be besieged in Varanasi by beggars and lepers and things you just don't see in this country. And many people would become quite disturbed at the sight of these conditions. It was difficult not to. And I often would be the one who would, among others of us, who would try to help them through it, because this was a pilgrimage after all, and we didn't want people to spend it with a hood over their head weeping in the bus. You know, we were trying to engage in this experience. And I began to realize over the years of doing this that people's inability to cope with difficult conditions that they were observing was pretty much exactly in proportion to the degree to which they had accepted in their own lives the fact that God will also teach me through hard times and suffering. There's a point in our Festival of Light every week. It's called the second stage. God sends us out. There's this little bird, which is the image, represents the soul. And God sends us out on this great mission. And we're supposed to be fruitful and multiply. And we're supposed to share with others as we have received, just as God has shared with us. But we get out there and we start, this is how the analogy is told. The bird starts flying around and he enjoys his power and he sort of sees that he can make a lot happen, and I begin to learn to manifest and I begin to accomplish things in my life and I begin to be respected and I get more and more comfortable and all of these different things that begin to happen, and we begin to think, why should I give all this away? After all, this is what I've accomplished. And the bird asks the question, what else is wisdom if not to keep what is mine for myself? Very often in the course of Ananda, we joke a lot. And whenever I feel like being selfish, I say, as Swamiji says in the Festival of Light, what else is wisdom except to keep what is mine for myself? Of course, he quotes it as a wrong thought, but he wrote it nonetheless. So that's what the bird says. And so we say, and thus the bird enters the second stage of the soul's long journey away from its home in God, the stage which is called the revolt. Now, it's very important in our lives to understand the extent to which we cling to that second stage. Life is created not by our egos, but life is created by a divine force that has our best interests at heart and knows what it's doing and is bringing us from limitation to bliss. And yet, when circumstances don't match our preferences, how often we simply revolt. No, it shouldn't be this way. It doesn't have to be this way. I don't like it this way. So I was saying back there in India, the extent to which we are still in rebellion against the obvious fact, if we pay any attention at all, that often God cannot get our attention unless somehow or another the pressure becomes great enough that we define it as pain, and then suddenly we're willing to consider what we were never willing to consider before. The extent to which we have come to calm acceptance of that fact enables us to look at everyone else living out their karma, may be karma very strange from our own. But nonetheless, exactly the same thing is happening. The bubble of bliss inside of them is bursting the skin of their comfortable ability to maintain in this world, and they're having to grow a new reality in order to brace what's trying to come through them. And the more calmly, and that I was starting to say a moment ago, when Jesus speaks of the perfection of God, what he's really saying to us is, don't just be fooled by appearances. Don't think if you can just get your little life organized and keep your profile low enough and make it through, you know, without anything really bad happening, that somehow you've been victorious. Yogananda says an easy life is not necessarily a victorious life. At the end of this, everything goes away. Our whole reality of this little personality and so on, this body, all of our possessions, it all goes away. But what does not leave us is the size and the dimensions of that bubble of joy. And the more enormous we have allowed that joy to become because we have willingly accepted what comes unasked to us as the healing strokes of God, then the more powerfully we move forward. We entered this life with a certain stage of that understanding. God has done his best to expand our understanding. At the moment of passing from this life, it is what Swamiji called the final exam, in which we finally get to see how much we've actually learned in this life and how much wisdom we get to take forward for the next round of this ever-expanding experience. Paramhansa Yogananda writes, "From joy I came, for joy I live, in sacred joy I melt." God wants us to know that, not merely as a deeply poetic experience, but in the perfection of our own being. "Be ye therefore perfect," Jesus told us, "in the way that God is perfect, for nothing less will ever satisfy us."